where I say, well, we're going to encourage a lot of participation early on. What I'm going to try to do is just give you an information dump and a lot of things to consider, and then at the end we'll take some time for some question and some interaction. I'd rather have selected points where we stop and actually interact with the material a little bit than just random free flow of conversation. So I'll wait for just a minute for the material to go around. But before I actually get into what we're going to talk about for the day, let's start with a particular assumption. Most of you are familiar with the word, the gospel. So what does that mean? Just when you hear the word, the gospel, the words, the gospel. Anybody? Okay, it's good news. And in particular, we could say that the gospel is generally referring to good news about what? I mean, is it good news like you just hit the lottery? Is that, I mean, that would be a gospel, certainly. Okay, so it's God's good news. It's good news about the prospects or the possibilities for man to know God and man to relate to God. But why do we call that good news? As a matter of fact, some would say that's not good news. Some would say that that's just a fairy tale or a hoax. And understand this, I'm probably going to break down some of your beliefs before we get around to rebuilding them. So every one of you should be prepared early on to be very uncomfortable. Maybe even not to like me for a little while. That's okay. You'll fall into a long list of people who are already there. But is the gospel really good news if it's not true? Suppose you were to build all of your life, all of your adult life, we'll just discount your childhood. Suppose that you were to build 50 years of adult life on good news that wasn't true. What would that make us who were spokespeople for the gospel if the gospel turned out not to be true at all? What would it make people who espouse belief in God and that God was possible to know and relate to if in the end it turned out that it was nothing but a fairy tale and you lived your whole life on a lie? Would that be good news? That we've all heard people say, well, it makes me feel better. And if it does nothing but make me feel better and help me to cope and get through life, I suppose that would be good news. But the truth is, here's the uncomfortable truth, the gospel properly understood is not a solution to all of life's comforts. As a matter of fact, the gospel properly understood and lived out might make your life more difficult. So if this is the one and only life that you have, why would you choose to make your life more difficult than need be? See, most of us take for granted that this is true, but have you ever heard any arguments that say, well, there is no God? Have you ever heard any arguments that say that everything that you believe is nothing but feel-good stuff and that there isn't any substance to it? And as a matter of fact, have any of you ever doubted yourself? Right, is there a sane person in this room who hasn't had significant doubts already? Having listened to a number of debates about a variety of things, and not just talking about the difference between, we'll say, theism and atheism, but debates about almost anything, here are a few things that I've discovered, and you can see them listed. It's at the top of the first page. What are some of the compelling reasons why you might believe one position over another? And the first is the power of the argument itself. It just feels true. It sounds true. There seems to be evidence to support it. But there's an equally compelling reason, and that is the power of the presenter. Have you ever seen a bad argument in the hands of a good presenter, and by the time the day was done, the bad argument seemed more believable than the believable one? In other words, the skills of the person on the side of right were so lacking that they couldn't make truth seem true. And the person representing what we'd say a more dubious position. They were eloquent. They were convincing. They had all the right pauses at the right places. They seemed to have all their facts in line. When they stood at the podium, they didn't drop their papers on the floor. You know what I'm talking about. They seemed, looked, and felt believable. So here's an uncomfortable question. What if we've just listened to the better presenters and not the better argument? Could we believe something only because the presentations were more effective and not because the substance underneath it was more valid? Here's the next one. And this is going to be particularly pertinent to what we're going to talk about for the next few weeks. The understandability of the argument. Have you ever watched some detective show, or maybe it's some science show, and after about 3 minutes into the explanation by the expert, you were confused? Really confused? You had no idea what they were talking about anymore? They started out, and it seemed like for the first 5 seconds it was understandable, and then pretty soon they lost you. Some of what we're going to talk about is frankly difficult to understand. How many of you feel that you have a lot to do already? How many of you have, let's say, 3 or 4 or 5 hours a week free to invest into understanding why you believe what you believe?
If I'm honest.
You could find it, but it would be difficult, and it would be a choice. Here's the truth. Sometimes it's easier to believe something that's easy to understand, even if what is easy to understand isn't true. And just as true, it is easy for people who believe something else and who are effective arguers on behalf of that to make truth seem stupid because they make their side of this argument more believable and understandable. Sometimes some of this stuff is very difficult to understand. Now here's the next one. The amount of energy and emotion and the years of life that you invested in your current belief. How many years have you been a Christ follower? What would it take if I were to stand up here and I were to be able to argue on behalf of no God? The absence of God, we'll just say that. Which by itself is biased, but we'll get into that in a minute. Suppose I had all the facts on my side, what would it take for you to believe that? A large part of that would depend on how many years and how much emotional investment had been spent in your living the life that you did live and believing what you did believe. In other words, it's possible for a human being simply to continue to believe what they have believed because it would be too difficult to let go of that belief and move to another one. And we're going to see why that's pertinent to people who believe differently than we do as well. That at the end of the day, we are as much emotion as we are logic, and that sometimes it is not logic that convinces us or keeps us where we are, but emotion. Here's another one. We'll compare this to marriage. How many of you have ever been in a discussion with your wife? And your wife brought up a point, and discussion is sort of a useful... let's call it a heated discussion. How many of you have ever been in a heated discussion with your wife, and your wife brought up a point, and deep down inside, you were kind of suspicious that she was right, but just the way in which she made the point to you made you not want to allow her to be right? Well, honey, you always say this. Why do you have to say that? Why couldn't you say it differently? And we dig in our heels at points like that. Why? Anybody? Pride?
I want to be right.
I want to be right. Who wants to be wrong? Quick, show of hands. Who wants to be wrong today? Right? Why don't people come around to see things our way? Or why don't we come around to see things their way? There's as much of an element of human pride as anything else. The grace and the tact with which we make an argument, even that is a contentious word, isn't it? The grace and the tact with which we present something will go a long way toward influencing or disinfluencing someone from coming around to seeing things from our side. Have you ever heard the gospel presented in a contentious way? Do you understand what I'm saying? Have you ever heard true, what we'll call truths for the time being, we'll suspend judgment on that. Have you ever heard the truth of the gospel message presented in a way that even though you were a believer, you thought to yourself, if I wasn't a believer, I certainly wouldn't become one today? You see, you can hear the right argument presented in the wrong way and presented in a combative way, and even if it is truth, you wouldn't believe it just because it irritates you too much to believe it. What does that say? Again, we're as much emotional creatures as we are logical creatures. Right? Spock wouldn't behave that way. Spock would automatically just say, "Oh, that sounds logical. I believe that." All right. So let's start at the beginning here. Whenever you walk into a church, there's a presupposition. And the presupposition is this, and it's expressed in one or another way. We know that God exists, therefore. And everything that follows that is built on what? The fact that we know that God exists. That's kind of biased, isn't it? It honestly is. And so when a person is what we'll call skeptical or neutral, let's just say neutral. When a person is neutral and we immediately invest in the statement, because God exists, we know these other things to be true, you've lost that person right away. Maybe they're not willing to embrace the idea that God exists. So I think the better place to begin, which is why I said we're going to have to tear out some foundations before we build them back up, is if there were a God, what would the world look like? If there were a God, how might the universe function? And so we're going to begin today with the if there were a God. And we need to do that because most of us become believers in what I'll call the middle of the movie. You've heard me describe this already. You walk into church for the first time, you pick up a book for the first time, you do something for the first time, and you make a commitment to go in a certain direction. Do you feel like the day you make that decision you knew all the facts and the figures and the answers to everything? No, you don't. And there's a lot that came before you. As a matter of fact, even if you start in the book of Genesis, right, we'll take the scripture as, for the moment, an authoritative source. We'll come back to that. But if you were to begin at the very beginning of the book of Genesis and you would say, "Oh, finally I'm at the beginning." But are you really at the beginning? No, because when you read partway through the book of the Bible, the books that we call scripture, you find out that there were things that happened before the beginning. There was actually a beginning before the beginning. So what is the beginning? So now I've confused half of you already. But this is not an Abbott and Costello routine. All of us come to faith. All of us stake a claim. We say, "I will from this moment on follow Jesus," based on a certain set of assumptions. But then later on, we have to learn what all of that means. I want to make sure that the foundation on which you build your confidence is a solid foundation. Because if you have a rotten foundation, you know what's going to happen? Your life is it's going to be exactly like Jesus described in the person who built his house on the sand. Why would somebody build a house on the sand?
Because it's pretty.
Not only because it's pretty, what else? Okay, one at a time. You bet it is. No foundational work needed, right? You ever dug in the ground? It's hard work. I mean, even in sand, it's somewhat hard work. Think about the extra time. It's time-consuming to build a foundation. It's hard to build a foundation. Therefore, most people of faith do not build a solid foundation. They take somebody else's word for half of what they believe, and Jesus says, that'll get you pretty far. When are you going to find out if you've built with a solid foundation? Well, let's take Jesus' words. When are you going to find out if you've built with a solid foundation under it?
When the storm comes.
And when the storm comes, is that a good time to find out if you need to do some construction work?
Like I said, it was pretty.
Have you ever found out that the backup battery that's powered your sump pump didn't work only after the rains came? See, the right time to find out if you've built on a solid foundation is when all is calm and tranquil. And yet, who wants to do that work when you could be doing so many other fun things when the sun is shining? And so what I'm encouraging all of us to do is take the time while you're not in crisis mode to determine if you're satisfied with the foundation that you've built. Okay. I posed a question before and I said, can we know if God exists? But then I said that's biased because what does it do? It introduces God and presupposes the argument based around the central point of God. So instead, I want to back up one step further, and we're going to begin our discussion today with this: what best explains reality as we see and know it? And here's the list, and it's on the front side of your front page. What best explains the origins of the universe, or something from nothing? Why do we have, as some philosophers say, something at all instead of nothing? Question number two, why do we have an orderly something instead of a disorderly something? Why do we have this something? Now, how many of you spent a lot of time this week thinking to yourself, I wonder why we have something instead of nothing? Not all of us. Not most of us. What if we... Okay, and I'm going to impose for a moment my theistic viewpoint into this. Maybe it's premature, but what if we live in a world that is surrounded by evidence and miracle, but because it is so everyday and common, we no longer see it? And there are people who invest all of their lives in looking at it every day. Here's something that's unsettling. They don't all see it as being miraculous. They see it perhaps as being amazingly complex, but they don't see it all as miraculous, i.e. having some supernatural source. So what best explains the fact that we have something rather than nothing? What best explains the fact that we have order rather than chaos in the something? Those are two powerful questions that deserve an answer. Or, said a different way, is it possible that something can come from nothing? Here, let me catch you up on this. Go to the last page, which would be the back side of your second page.
Like your original argument of emotion is typically what causes that kind of thing. I don't know, I'm uncomfortable. Now we're having a discussion about whether this exists or not, and I don't know, and I'm uncomfortable. So I'm just as soon scurry away from it, or Mythbuster it out. Mythbusters always has the solution. I gotta figure out how to make that happen. So in our absolute fear of the unknown, we have to make up some sort of our own story that we can get our little heads around to make it okay for us.
And incidentally, this is the charge that most naturalists, and I'll use the word naturalist rather than atheist a lot of the time, because when you and I use the word atheist in a religious setting, what does that sound like? Does that sound like a neutral word? Not at all. And so right there, when we give someone a label who is different than we are, we've set them apart from us. And remember what we said about what happens when you and your wife are having a discussion and you tend to dig in your heels? Because we're emotional creatures. See, our goal is not to be right. Our goal is to be effective representatives of the gospel. Hold on to what Jimmy said, because I need to back up and tell you three things. I want to build a foundation under your belief. I want you to be able to be confident in what you believe when the storms come, but I also want us all to be effective advocates for the gospel. Because if it really is true and it really is good news, then we want to be able to share it effectively. Sometimes we just don't feel that we have compelling ability to share it effectively. Now let's come back to what Jim said. And Jim said, that sometimes we don't know, and so we need to slap some explanation on top of something. Many naturalists say, well, that's exactly what the myth stories of creation are. They are simply primitive attempts of humankind to provide some explanation for the source of what we see. And the naturalist says, but as we come to learn more and more about the way the universe functions, we can see that these are nothing but myth stories. And incidentally, they say, every culture, every civilization has some sort of myth story about the origins of the universe, and therefore it's just the common condition of humankind that they seek to explain what they don't know. But as we come to better understandings, we can dismiss the myths of the past. Now, at face value, doesn't that sound convincing?
It sounds nice. Sure.
It does, doesn't it? Now, remember what I said? How many of you have 3, 4, or 5 hours a week to invest in discovering why you believe what you believe? Do you realize how many different scientific pursuits would be necessary just to answer the first question? The first question about reality on that page. What best explains something from nothing and order from chaos? Just those two questions take a dozen or more fields of science to answer.
But the problem with that is that they don't know either. They're just theorizing, because science is nothing but math. They're theorizing.
Okay.
No, either. I don't know that God exists. I believe God exists.
Yes.
It's different.
Well, you're absolutely right. However, they make the better argument.
Well, I've got numbers and X's and Y's and parentheses, and look at my chalkboard. It's filled with information. I have to be right.
Okay. Stand down. You made your point. You made it well. Remember what we said, how we introduced this. I will tend to believe something not only based on the power of the argument, but on the power of the presenter and the way in which he does it. So a weak theist coming up against a strong naturalist, who wins at the end of the day? The strong naturalist wins, the weak theist.
And saying strong and weak, it's just the guy who's presenting the debate. The guy who's debating. It's the better lawyer at the end of the day.
Yes, it is.
OJ went free.
Yes, he did. Or to say it in a different way, and this is a favorite phrase of mine from the past, when you're strong on the facts, pound the facts. And this is lawyer phrase. When you're strong on the facts, pound the facts. When your argument is strong on the law, pound the law. When your argument is strong on neither, pound the table. And that really is a clever way of saying the obvious, that when you can't, when you have nothing on your side, if you're a skilled presenter, you can probably skate by. Question number two. What best explains the predictability of nature? In other words, how is it that the natural world is so predictable that we can even develop laws to describe it? Now, that's a subset of predictability. That's a subset of order rather than chaos. But it's not just that there is some order. There is predictable order so that nature seems to behave in exactly the same way every day. You don't need to worry when you walk out your front door tomorrow that you're going to float instead of your feet hitting the sidewalk. Why? You don't need to worry that the ocean is suddenly going to shift and wash over all the United States tomorrow. Because there's a fine tuning to the way the universe works. You don't need to worry about all these things. They are not only reasonably predictable, but they are also extremely measurable. And if that were not so, man could never have set foot on the moon. We could never have put satellites into space. We could never have put exploring satellites out beyond our own solar system. So there is a predictability that allows us to do all kinds of things. It requires an explanation. Or you just take it for granted.
Or your experiences on your own tell you that. Because every day when I walk out of the house, I don't float into space. My own experience is what tells me something. I'm not believing you. They shot how many things up, tried to shoot how much stuff up in space before the first one actually went.
You're getting ahead of me.
Oh, I'm sorry.
No, that's okay. You're getting ahead of me. Well, as a matter of fact, no, let's go. Let's take Jim's lead. Go to the, for you it will be the first side of the second page. I did have a good order that I was going to present this in, and I was actually debating all more.
No,
because it was a valid point, so I wasn't exactly sure where to introduce each point. Here's the deal. There is so much that needs to be talked about all at once, and yet you can't talk about everything at once. You have to start somewhere. So you've got to stay with this until everything is out on the table. We're going to look at what I'm calling six books of Revelation. The first two you're familiar with. It's what we call the book of nature. Okay, it's everything in the created order that we look at, and can we derive some understanding or meaning from it? The second is the book of Scripture. The next is the book of human experience. And here's what I mean by that. There are people in the world who have experienced things that I haven't. Right? There are people in the world who have seen things that I haven't. At some points in my life, I am going to have to trust the experiences of others because my experiences alone are not complete to help me understand the world, even this one planet. I've never been to certain places in the world that other people have. I have to trust that they've reported that accurately. I haven't had experiences. I've never given birth, thankfully. I have not had that experience. And therefore, I have to trust people who have had that experience to tell me that it's painful. Maybe they're lying. Maybe it's not painful. Maybe women just like to shout and yell a lot in the delivery room. Who knows? None of us in this room know, do we? So we have to take on faith certain other people's experiences. That's a book of knowledge. Here's the next one. My personal experience. And just the same as other people's experiences are not identical to mine, mine are not identical to other people's. And so I have to at some point trust my own experiences. Now we're moving gradually into the realm of faith. Here's the next book, the book of the community of the faithful. If there is a God and God is interacting with a particular group of people, then I should be able to observe the community that God is interacting with and learn some things about God just by watching how God relates to the people that He calls His own. And if you're not sure that this is a conclusive piece of evidence, consider God's plan for Abraham. What was God's plan for Abraham? To become a people, to become a nation. What was God's plan for that nation? Not to be exclusive, which they thought it turned out to be. They misunderstood the plan. The plan was that God would interact with a specific group of people, and as He interacted with that specific group of people, that all the outside observers would say, oh, now I see how God relates to people. And they would be drawn to it and attracted to it. So we can look at how God interacts with the faithful and learn something about God from that. And finally, the last book, and it takes some faith to accept this book, it's the incarnate appearance of God. It is Jesus. Can we learn some things about God by observing or by reading about what Jesus did? Because that is a special kind of revelation, and so we're going to call it a book by itself. So that's the collection of different research or books that we're going to look at. Okay, back to the list. Here's a really powerful one. Origins of life. Why do we live in a world with order, but also with living things in addition to order? We can live in a bare solar system. What are the origins of life? So 100 plus years ago, I mean, was it the 100th anniversary of Darwin? Something or other that we just celebrated. I forget what it was. I think it was the 100th anniversary. So 100 years ago, nowhere near as much about the complexity and the sophistication of life was known as we know today. And so when Darwin concluded that there must just be these couple of little things that swam around in the pond and they, out of these little acids and energy forms that life sprouted, you can chuckle, but at the time it seemed like a reasonable theory, and Darwin was ahead of his time in his ability to observe things, way ahead of his time. See, you can chuckle and you can derisively dismiss it, but the reality is that Darwin's ideas caught on because they were believable and compelling at the time. They didn't catch on because they were the ramblings of a fool. Understand that. Darwinism is not the predominant viewpoint in its varying forms today because it was an idiotic concept. It was because it had believability. It had more believability than the explanatory power of what the theists had to offer. Which is why it's gradually gained the high ground. Do you understand what I'm saying? So it's not stupid ramblings.
People today still drink the Kool-Aid.
Here's the challenge. Darwin didn't know what we know about the complexity even within a single cell. Darwin did not understand in the way that we have come to understand since we've cracked the genetic code that even within one cell there are millions of pieces of coded information that tell that one cell what to do it, how to interact with the remaining cells that it has to connect with, and also how to produce its own kind and not something else. And it's been described by those who study it as being more sophisticated than computer after computer. And all in code that is so seemingly, and I don't want to bias or pollute the water, but seemingly so intelligently designed that it is almost impossible to explain how it could randomly develop. Many of you have probably heard this phrase used to describe some of this order. It would be like a tornado going through a junkyard and on the other side out popped a Boeing 747. What would be the odds of that happening? Jimmy's already identified it, but here's the phrase I'm going to use. Everyone has a backstop. The naturalist will say, well, you all people believe in the God of the gaps. In other words, whenever you can't explain something, you say, oh, you just insert God. That explains it. And they will say, well, that's not an answer. Does the naturalist have an answer? Well, the truth is that most of them have large blocks of gap. As a matter of fact, as more recently more has come to be known about these questions that we've already asked, how many of you are familiar with what the multiverse is? So the multiverse is an explanation that goes like this. Okay, it is really difficult to explain how all of what we see exists. It is really difficult to explain the order that we have in the unliving world. It is even more difficult to explain how life sprang up from nothing, and it is even more difficult to explain how complex life exists in the forms that it does. We don't have a good satisfactory answer, and despite what some will say in the way of bluster and bluff, they don't have an explanation for how life arose. And so here is their explanation. There is probably more than one universe. As a matter of fact, there are probably multiple universes, hence the multiverse. And out of all the universes that exist, it is unquestioning that one of them could support life. So here's the way this goes. Some wise mathematician or collection of mathematicians has crunched the numbers and they have determined that there are X number of particles in the universe. It's a big number. It's a really big number. And here's what they say. If you were to take all the particles in the universe and you were to arrange them in a specific order, one of those orders would represent us. In other words, all the particles that make up you would be ordered right there. Now, there might only be one universe in all the universes in whatever goes beyond universes in which you would be you, but there would be one. And in all the other ones, it wouldn't look like you. And there might be chaos and confusion and all that. But in one of these universes, everything as we see it would exist. There's a different way of describing it. Any of you familiar with the infinite monkeys phrase? It says this. If you were to set a collection of monkeys down at typewriters, and you were to allow them to peck away on their typewriter keys infinitely, sooner or later, even a dumb monkey would be able to peck out the lines of William Shakespeare. By mere chance, enough monkeys assembled could create a great body of work, just by chance. And that, in essence, is a different way of explaining that if you took all of the particles of matter in all of the universe and you arranged them in just one order, we'd have what we have. And so the naturalist's explanation for why we have what we have is that there are an infinite number of other universes, and it happens to only be our universe that has this order. So I'm going to ask you a simple question. Remember, everybody has a backstop. For the naturalist, the multiverse is their backstop. They don't know it exists, but they trust that it exists. I want you to understand that. There is no evidence that there are multiple universes. They have faith that the multiverse exists. Is it at least as sane, is it at least as sensible to believe that something outside of time and space could have been the origin for what we see now, as it is that there are an infinite number of particle universes, only one of which happens to look like ours? Doesn't matter which side of the divide you're on, you have to have faith in something. So whenever somebody says that this is proved or that's fact or whatever, no, it's really not. There's a great deal of speculation on both sides. And here's the reality that proves that. There's no knockout punch that proves or disproves God on either side. See, if there was, we wouldn't be in this room right now having this discussion. We'd be talking about, I don't know, how to spread mulch out in the front lawn or something like that. We'd be having a different discussion. The reason we're having this discussion is because there is no knockout punch, and people of all persuasions come to the end of their knowledge, the end of their understanding, and they have to trust something. Okay, and then we get into some of the more complex ones. What explains humans? What explains what differentiates us from all the other created order? Why do we seem to be one of the few living creatures on Earth that has self-awareness? You know what I mean by self-awareness, right? I have some cats. I don't imagine that my cats think about the meaning of life all day long as they sit on a shelf and look out the window, right? We do. We think about questions like, why are we? And why are we where we are and who we are? We ask those kinds of questions. Why is it that out of all the creatures, why don't dolphins build cities? Oh, okay. Okay, they don't have opposable thumbs. Sorry. Well, Scott, given how much time most kids today spend on their phones, that could be our undoing yet, too. Now, a naturalist will say this, that the reason that human beings have gone to the top of the intellectual chain is because of fire. Fire allowed us to cook meat. Because we could cook meat, we could digest meat more readily. Because we could digest it more readily, we didn't lose as many calories in the killing and the eating of the meat, because it takes a lot of calories to digest raw meat. I don't know if any of you ever knew that or not. But the only reason that we are able to benefit so much from meat and proteins is because we're able to process them in ways that we can gain more calories from ingesting than we lose from the process of digestion. And that has contributed to our having a larger brain. That's the naturalist's explanation. Now, it's a little bit, admittedly, I did a really bad job of explaining that, and if you were to have a naturalist here, he would do a much better job of explaining it. So I don't want to be derisive and ridiculing the naturalist's position. And there's probably some truth to that. But does that alone explain why we are the predominant being on the face of the earth? And you just can't deny that we are. You don't see raccoons building cities. And if you were to assemble all the squirrels in the known world and you were to put them together and return 5,000 years later, what would squirreldom look like? My supposition is it would look pretty much the same. If you were to take all the known humans in the world and put them together, okay, it would look like the mess we have. Maybe the squirrel should rule the world. But wouldn't things be different? Of course they would. What explains that? Why we are so different from every other creature? What explains a moral law is another question. It seems as if there are universals of right and wrong that we tend to take for granted. We sort of instinctively know that killing kids is wrong, that raping babies is wrong, that doing certain things, it just doesn't feel right. It seems to be wrong. We're shocked by it. Why are we shocked by it? Where does that sense of outrage and shock come from? And why is it all but universal? Finally, we'll talk about one other thing, and we're not going to get that to that until the end of things. But what explains evil? Why do we all have a sense of outrage over evil? And so the question that we're going to, this is the first question that we build this case on. Is there any such thing as truth? Is there any such thing as truth? Does truth exist, or is truth solely a subjective thing? And for each of us, truth is different. So I want to camp there for a moment. Let's pause. Does anybody have any comments or questions about what we've talked about so far? This is a great time to have an interaction.
When you were just talking about the power of the presenter before I go, that is always going to be what happens. The reason the naturalist wins is because he presents well. He knows the information, and he can say to you this and this and this and this line up, and this lines up. Like I said, all the X's and the parentheses are on the chalkboard. He's got a great argument. What do you have? Well, we go to church. Just like you said, we don't spend a lot of time really researching this. And in the book, when it says, have a good argument. When someone comes to you and says, hey, why do you read this? Have a good argument. Be able to actually have an argument with somebody about what you believe. You know what I mean? Because we can get into it at where I work. And the cool thing about it is there's another Christian there, and he's much more low-key than I am. But every one of these conversations we have, I went, every one of them. I have this sitting open on my thing. He says, well, what about this? It says this. Where? Right there. That's where it says. I went, well, how do you know that? You don't know it. You believe it. There's a difference. You believe it, too. You don't know. Nobody in here could explain the law of gravity. Probably. I don't want to make any assumptions. But we all believe it. Why? Because we're sitting here. It's our own life experience that causes us to even look for this. Our own life experience. Someone compels us with, he's a nice guy. He's really cool. And so we start the search. And if the search gets too hard, or one jerk steps in our way that says, well, that's it, I'm done. But if we were all really good debaters, gentle arguers, we could say, well, let's reason this out. You and me, let's sit down over a cup of coffee and reason this out together. That would get them. But we hit them with it instead.
And Jim, your point about naturalists tend to take only certain aspects, you know, things that they can prove.
Oh, yeah.
Like Glenn was saying, you know, animals don't create cities. Well, they don't have emotion, right? They're not drawn together like we as humans are, right? So a naturalist will only approach things that he can identify, but he has no explanation for those bigger, unexplainable things.
But he'll try.
And admittedly, many of them are intangibles. You can't put your finger on it. And so we're going to talk now. This makes for a nice segue. Is there such a thing as truth? And if there is such a thing as truth, how would we define it? And are there different kinds of truth? So we'll just read this thing. Does truth exist? So we could say that reality is a collection of observable conditions or experiences which we all describe similarly. We'll stop right there for a moment. I'm sure many of you know that the male of the species is more prone toward colorblindness, right? Men are some high percentage more likely to be partially or totally colorblind than women, right? So, Does the fact that one man cannot perceive red and tell it from green, does that disprove the fact that light reflects differently off of different surfaces and therefore renders things in different colors? Does that disprove that because one person doesn't have that experience? No, it doesn't. And so what we say is, while every individual may not experience something exactly the same, one way that we can determine if something is true is if enough people experience it similarly. Does that make sense? And so that's one kind of truth. The fact that there is some abnormality, some anomaly, some exception to the rule doesn't disprove the rule. It just means that there might be further explanation required. All right. There are things which we say are true. They are universally true or appear to be true for those who are able to observe them. The color blindness. This is the first essential for discovery. There must be a body of things that we share in common and thus can refer to as true or truth. They are real and certain, or as certain as anything can be. So what different kinds of truth are there? And I've made a short list here, and you might want to write some of these down. First off, there's tangible versus intangible truths. We hold these truths to be self-evident. Can anyone fill in the rest of that? Yeah. And endowed by? Okay. And we don't even need to go further. My point wasn't to make the point about the Creator. My point was, what are those truths? Are they tangible? Can I put my finger on them? Can I mathematically analyze them? I can't. The proposition, and we'll call that a propositional truth. The propositional truth is this, that there are certain things that appear to be true about all human beings, but you can't put your finger on it. You can't mathematically analyze it. So some truths are intangible. Some truths are observable. We all see them the same way, or essentially the same way. We know that they're minor variations because our senses are not all the same. Scott needs glasses to see. If you took Scott's glasses off, he wouldn't understand truth quite the same. But yet, our perceptions are generally the same. The scientific community or the naturalistic community, and I don't want to, we're not at odds with them. As a matter of fact, as somebody has said, it's really not religion that is opposed to science or science that is opposed to religion. It is naturalists that are opposed to theists. And there's a world of difference. Some things are observable, some things are repeatable. Scientific discovery depends upon the repeatability of certain things. Let me illustrate. And this is why we say there are repeatable things and there are historical things. Suppose that a man, a butcher in Boston, were to be murdered. And then we were to discover later, by doing forensic work, that it was a baker in Philadelphia who killed the butcher in Boston. Would it then follow as truth that all bakers in Philadelphia, whenever they were in the presence of butchers in Boston, automatically killed Boston butchers? Would it? No, it wouldn't, would it? We don't know that that would ever be repeated again, that a baker in Philadelphia would kill a butcher in Boston. That is a historical event. And you might wonder, well, what does this have to do with science? When science attempts to explain one-time historical events by their likelihood of repeatability, they fail. We cannot explain the origins of the universe, in other words, what we'll loosely call the Big Bang, we cannot explain that in terms of a repeatable event. It was a one-time event. When skeptics doubt the viability or the credibility of miracles, what do? They're saying, based on naturalistic observation, miracles do not happen all the time. They are not universally experience. And because they are not universally experienced and repeatable, therefore they don't exist. They're hallucinations. They are inventions of the human mind. But you see, the Boston butcher illustration debunks that. Just because Scott experienced a miracle and I say, well, I've never experienced a miracle in my whole life, does that disprove Scott's miracle? No, it doesn't. Did you all understand what I said? Because this is profound. Because a person with a naturalistic worldview will tend to say, this is not universal, it's not repeatable, therefore it doesn't exist. And anyone who doubts miracles always has to say they are not commonly evidenced. To which we might question, would we call them miracles if they were commonly evidenced? Human life is a miracle when you think about it. Right? We all experience it, don't we? Every one of us. If you're in the room this morning, you're experiencing the miracle of human life. Do you marvel at it? Are you amazed at it anymore? No. Not at all. So several different types of truths. Tangible versus intangible, observable versus not observable, repeatable or not repeatable, which makes them historical, and experiential. Am I boring you all? You're a very quiet group. Can you repeat that a little louder?
It sounds like a lot of what you're saying, that if it doesn't make, like, it doesn't have logic to it, if it doesn't have to do with what I can understand the word, then it can't be.
Then it can't be.
Then it can't be.
Okay. Well, and that's why we introduced those six books of Revelation. Because when you and I describe something that was a personal experience for us, the person who is bound by the laws of nature will say, well, that's not a repeatable experience in everybody else's life. Everyone has not experienced the same thing. Therefore, it cannot be true. That's why we have to introduce all these different forms of revelation and say without them, we'll have an incomplete understanding. As a matter of fact, what we're going to see next week, he's like, if God proves to be at least a credible explanation for the origins of reality, what do we know about God? Can we know more about God than nature can reveal, is the next question. If the reality as we see it leads to at least the credibility that God might exist, would God be knowable? And if God were knowable, how would we get to know Him better beyond what nature reveals? And that's why we need additional forms of revelation. All right. I want to talk for a moment. We're going to get into this does God exist question. If you were to have said the word atheist 100 years ago, you know, even in our country, it would have been used sort of as a derisive word. It would have been used to describe an extremely small minority of people. Not all people were, we'll say, followers of Christ. They had not had some, we'll call it, born-again experience. But, nonetheless, they had some belief in some sort of deity. Today there is an open and growing presence of what we're going to call skeptics. Barna describes skeptics as two groups of people. Those who are flat out atheistic, which means that they disbelieve God. And then there are those who say there's not right now enough information to make a determination as to whether there is a God. And so here's what's happened, and this is in a 20-year period. So let me write a couple of numbers up here on the board. Anybody remember where you were in 1993? Scott, what kind of a marker did you give me?
Well, you may perceive it as being empty, but I believe it was.
Was that with your glasses on or without? Were you able to perceive reality accurately, Scott?
Well, the truth of the matter is that
you're not invited back here anymore. Here's the second year. All right, good span of time. Here are some findings from Barna. Barna, if you don't know, focuses on certain issues that are related to the church and evaluates the condition of the culture related to the church. They try to do polls, and they try to do them in the most unbiased and we'll say scientific way possible. In the year 1993, approximately 16% of all self-identified atheists, and they will just do phone interviews, and they'll call up thousands of people, and they'll pose this question after they explain what it is that an atheist is. We're going to use the word skeptic from now on. That's my bad. 18% of people self-identified as being skeptical who were under the age of 30. As of the year 2013, those who identified as skeptical, 34%. So we went from 18% to 34%. I'm going somewhere with this, so just be patient. 18% to 34%. Here's the next question. What's your level of education? So you've identified yourself as being a skeptic. What is your level of education? In 1993, those who were skeptical, 33% of them identified as having college education. 2003, 50% of them identified as having a college education. Now you might wonder, why is that an important statistic? So let's assume that I identify as having a fourth grade education. And then they posed to me this question, are you a believer or not believer? Well, I've got a fourth grade education, and no, I don't believe in God. And now they ask Scott. And Scott says, well, I have three PhDs, and I've spent most of my life in pursuing learning. And I do believe in God. Now, whose opinion are you going to take more seriously? Me, the one with the fourth grade education, or Scott, who has four advanced degrees? We're giving Scott the benefit of the doubt. And this is the part where you can contribute here, right? Nobody's going to take my beliefs seriously, are they? After all, I've only graduated from the fourth grade, and Scott, he's got multiple advanced degrees. Who would believe me? Now, what if I told you that all of Scott's advanced degrees were in ancient literature? Or what if I were to tell you that they were in ancient archaeology? What if I were to tell you that they were in dentistry? Would that really impact his understanding about God? It may not. So the mere fact that someone identifies as having more education does not necessarily make their understandings about the existence or the non-existence of God more credible. You understand what I said? If all of my training is in shoemaking, that doesn't make me more qualified to discern if God exists. But I did make the fifth grade, I just want you to know.
Okay, fifth grade, and you said you believe, and he said he didn't. I believe you, or I run with you. If you flip-flop the situation, the circumstance. So, it doesn't matter to me what kind of education you have. If you say you believe in it, I'll do that.
Okay. But we're saying that gradually, well, let me get the rest of the statistics out, and then we'll see why this can matter. Again, the 2 years, 1993, 2013, of those who identified as skeptics, women comprised 16% of them in 1993. Today, women comprise 43% of them. So in other words, going back 20 years ago, it was pretty much a small group of older men that were skeptical. Today, it's more pervasive and universal. Of those interviewed, of the skeptical population, in 1993, only 16% of them were women. So in other words, 84% of skeptics were men in the year 1993. As opposed to now we're saying that it's almost equal. that there's no gender difference, that it's more widely accepted. And this is where we're going. That a disbelief in God or a naturalistic viewpoint is becoming more and more pervasive in society. Could you close the door to John's cage? It seems like he's about to get loose, and he might do irreparable harm to those in polite society if he does. Valid points.
If I can add to that, and I'm not contradicting in any way, I'm a computer education teacher, and one of the things, and I attribute this to my age and my upbringing, I tell these kids often that, especially when they're doing projects, you need to stop and look at the validity of what you are looking at, because we are running into a problem. That's why I said information is available, but if you take 2013 to 2033 and you start asking that question, my thought would be that the number of people who grab information
skim through it quickly and look at Twitter, you get snapshots. Nobody reads, sits down and reads full articles and makes a decision and does a comparison, contrast comparison. That these numbers, in my opinion, are going to go even higher unless our presentation is better. And as a result of that, we're going to look at snapshots of information and we're going to base all of our decisions on that quick information that we receive. And the computer, the technology, is going to be the teacher, not the people who have the foundation and the understanding. And that's alarming to me because I just think that our youth are in so much trouble because they're going to just get information quickly in the palm of their hands and make that decision. And when you were talking about Darwinism, I was looking up on there because I had heard that Darwin had accepted Christ at his deathbed. But in reading through one of the articles, he didn't. He was actually a very religious person growing up in the church and was thought to become a priest at some point, but then he ended up connecting with another person, I think his name was like Lydell or something like that, who then intrigued him based on his writings. But it was believed that he never did go back to his belief in Jesus Christ and died as a non-believer, believing in what it is that he wrote. However, it does say, the argument is that there's so much information and rumor out there on the internet that people believe that Darwin went back and believed that Jesus Christ died and accepted Christ again. And it's not true. And so when you look at that, if you were to poll the kids today on something like that, they would probably look at that and say, oh yeah, I heard, or I saw, and someone wrote it. And I told them, you know, the information on the internet is only based on the information and the belief of that person. You cannot accept it for truth, and you cannot accept it as the value of being right. And kids don't get it. They just don't get it.
Okay. Let me make one comment about that, and then we're going to move on, because the purpose to my introducing this was to get to where do we derive our beliefs from. One of the great laments about almost anybody who is in the news business is that in times past, before an article went to print in a conventional newspaper, there was a great deal of vetting of the facts. In other words, something couldn't be printed theoretically unless it was true, and that was so because the printing publication would be held liable for any inflammatory or defamatory remarks. All right, so everything was researched because they understood what was at stake if they reported something falsely. But with what we'll call the democratization of information, in other words, everybody with an opinion can publish their opinion, vetting of information has dropped significantly. And so there is as much, and this is really a concern that people in the news business are talking about regularly. The truth has to compete with the fabrications of an inventive mind or the speculation of an inventive mind because it's all out there and it's up to the individual to discern what's true and what's just speculation. And that's a really tough job. All right, there was one other person had a comment or something I think was about to say. Go ahead. Interestingly, to speak to what you've said, and then we really do have to move on, One of the sub-findings of this poll was that those who identify as being skeptical, especially younger people, are less relational. In other words, they're not out interacting with other human beings so much as they are interacting with information. So if the information that they're interacting with is of lesser quality than it was, or if it's untested in its validity, then they're interacting with potentially false information. And remember, we're not denigrating a particular group of people. The same as we're not saying that, and this is one of the dilemmas that the church faces. It has a ton of bad history in terms of using a term like atheist in a derogatory way. A person who has not yet found reason to believe in God. That describes a whole lot of people, doesn't it? And it doesn't make them inferior. As a matter of fact, intellectually, many of them may be superior at times. The problem is that we have just branded them as a certain type of person. And it comes back to how we opened this. If your wife and you were having a discussion, and your wife backs you into a corner, the likelihood that you're ever going to say, "You're right, I see it your way," has been reduced significantly. And so when we back people into a corner who believe differently than we do, when we refer to them in derogatory terms, we lose even if we win. And typically we don't win anyway. And so what is your goal? Is your goal in the end to be able to confidently believe what you believe and to be able to share it out of love, or is your ability to win an is your desire to win an argument? Makes a world of difference. Okay, so where do we get our beliefs? And we're going to have to wrap up with this, so we're going to do it quickly. I've made a list here. You can see it at the bottom of the... Would that be your back side of the front page? Where do beliefs come from? Family of development. So just think about this. A lot of what you believe, you learn in your home. And I said the family of development because that's changing a lot. Originally, you could have said your biological family, and that would have pretty much summed it up. But wherever it is that your home life is centered around, you're going to pick up a lot of what you believe based on that. Do you see why these statistics are important, the ones we just used? If the dominant view of the origins of life is shifting, if more and more people are skeptical, and remember, we've already seen that a lot of what people put their faith in is faith. They don't have the answers. But if the view of the origins of life and the nature of God or God's lack of existence is becoming more common and popular in this country, and if that's the belief that's espoused in the household, then what's the next generation growing up believing? Now, when you were 6 years old, how many of you thought, "You know, I think my parents are not well educated, and therefore their beliefs should be called into question"? How many of you thought that? So by the time of 10, there's a lot of what you believe that has been instilled into you, and you have no way of knowing if it's accurate or not. Of course, the reverse could be true, right? And we want to be clear about that. There's plenty of religious households where a lot of, we'll call them peculiar beliefs, are espoused in the home. We'll just call them peculiar. And kids grow up to accept them. So what we want to see is where beliefs come from. A lot of them come from your household or your family of origin. Another collection come from formal education. Professional educators are themselves educated. Would you agree? It's necessary in this country. So if a greater percentage of those who are professionally educated are, we'll call them naturalists, it's almost impossible but what their worldview is going to spill over into their education. Let me give you an example of this. I got home last night from preparing for this. My wife flips on the television, and how many of you have ever seen the cartoon movies Ice Age? Right, the ones with the big woolly mammoth and whatever else, right? Well, for whatever reason, she leaves it on. I watched for a little while. I'm trying to go to sleep. Well, it's one of these like things where they have interviews with the directors and the producers and all that. So they show a little bit of the movie and then they describe a little bit about how the movie's made. So there's this one thing where there's these two animals and one of the directors is being asked why they chose these animals. And it says, well, it turns out that this, whatever the name of this creature was that's in this cartoon movie that's about this big, it turns out, they say, that the closest living relative to this small animal is the mammoth. And then he says, and this was just came out as naturally as could be, so somewhere back in the evolutionary chain, millions of years ago, this branch forked off from that one, and we have this mammoth thing and this little thing that are greatly related to each other. Now, I'm not diminishing the explanatory power of guided, we'll call it evolution. I'm not even going to dispute that. Okay? There's a lot of scientific research that suggests that some of that may be true. But what he was suggesting was that somehow some magical force arbitrarily split this from that somewhere back in the past, and he was not even intending to make a statement about his worldview. I want you to understand that. He was having a simple conversation, and his worldview spilled out all over the table while he was having that simple conversation. Now, if it can happen that innocently, what do you think the odds are that a person's worldview is going to spill out into the classroom and onto everyone in the classroom? Even when he or she doesn't intend it to.
I can say the same, because I have often felt that way. You go into a classroom, you cannot, legally, you can, but you cannot, you're not talking from a religious perspective anything, but your actions certainly can dictate what goes on in that classroom. And I've seen it happen, and I have used my own perspective with non-verbally and have shown that. And I've had former students who have told me that there was something different about the way I was in the classroom, and I see the opposite of that, and it does have an influence. Just as something as simple as look up this way, or look it up that way, or try to look at this perspective. There's all those influences that go into it.
Okay. Now, we've covered the accidental, and keep in mind that many of these classes are about topics that would require some sort of what we'll call worldview. The way you looked at things. In other words, if you were in a science class and there was some explanation required for a particular origin, there's certain language that would just naturally be used to explain it based on your theory of how things developed. So there's both accidental and intentional ways in which people are influenced during their formal education years. Keep in mind, we're still talking about kids, right? Remember what we said a minute ago. Your six-year-old probably doesn't question whether your beliefs are accurate or not, right? They just take it for granted. When a kid is in sixth grade, for the most part, they're not questioning whether the well-educated instructor that stands at the front of the room and is an expert in that topic, they're not questioning whether that person actually is allowing their beliefs to influence their teaching. They're not sophisticated enough in their reasoning power yet to even ask that question. And in addition to that, if you at home happen to disagree with it, who are you? You're just their parents. All right, certainly our peers have some influence on what we believe. If you doubt this, try to disagree with your friends around in a social setting, right? Doesn't it feel awkward and uncomfortable to dissent, to be the one person who views something completely differently? It can a lot of times. And so our peer group starts to fashion our belief system. Finally, we've got media and culture, and I'm not going to go into them because some people have just beaten them to death. You see where the last one is? Personal study and reflection. That's the last one on my list, and I put it there because how many sixth graders do you know that voluntarily say, I am going to set aside time for personal reflection and study? That doesn't happen a lot, does it? And let's be fair, it probably would be unnatural for many sixth graders to say, I think I'm going to do that. And so when, if ever, and you see some of you have already hit on this, when, if ever, are these awarenesses that I need to set aside time for personal reflection and study going to occur? Once a person is an adult. Would you agree? Yet where are the predominance of an individual's beliefs formed? How hard is it to overturn belief systems that have been ingrained in you for 15 years? How many of you have ever had a faith crisis in your life? I mean, a real crisis, and isn't it uncomfortable? You're not sure what to believe, you're not sure what to do. And sometimes it's easier to find a new distraction to take your mind off of that if you can. And so when many people, for the first time in their life, are afforded the opportunity for personal reflection and study, and that leads them to an uncomfortable point, and they don't have to deal with it, they'll let a distraction take over again. Because we're just hardwired to avoid discomfort and difficulty. We don't like it, and most of us will avoid it. Now, in light of all that, and I had to go through this after I saw those statistics, because it's like, where exactly do we come up with our beliefs? Most of the beliefs that we have are not really our own. We've inherited them. And we simply manage what's been given to us. And so if we live in a progressively more naturalistic worldview culture, our kids are going to inherit that belief system, and that's what they're going to take out, and it is going to feel natural and right, and they're going to struggle to ever overcome that. Well, admittedly, you're working with what we'll call at-risk kids, right? Or kids that have past problems. So you're more likely, in your circumstance, to find people who are lacking good influences in their life, or they might not have been as prone to find themselves in the positions that they are. But yet, we don't want to discount what you're saying. I forget what the exact number is. Something like 40% of people today will wake up in a home where their biological father doesn't live there. Right, and that I'm just talking a physical presence, and you're raising another issue. Now we'll get into that at some later time. But yeah, that could make a whole series by itself, which we don't. Right. I want to leave us with something on a positive note, and I gotta emphasize this, because here's what usually happens when a discussion like this takes place. Those who are of, we'll call it, let me use a cheesy phrase, those who are of the household of faith will go out and bash all the people who don't believe the same way and tell them how wrong they are. We got enough issues of our own. Let's put some foundation under what we believe first before we go out and sound like the lunatic fringe. Please. Okay? So do me a favor. If this is one of your first real exposures to this, don't all rush out tomorrow to be amateur apologists. Okay? Please, for the sake of all of humankind, just meditate and think about what we've talked about this morning. And we'll talk more next week. All right?